The White House announced last month that it will admit 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year, a tremendous increase from the fewer than 2,000 Syrians accepted since the civil war broke out there 4 years ago. I'm Sheila Cast, and today at noon on Midday, we follow the ongoing response to the refugee crisis in Europe. We'll hear from local nonprofits providing humanitarian aid. One of them is resettling Syrians here in Baltimore. We'll also talk about the complications people face in applying for refugee status and the challenges they must overcome to build a new life. Plus, we hear the personal story of an asylum seeker living in Baltimore who fled the genocide in Darfur. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you're with us. Let's talk about refugees. The White House says it will boost the number of Syrian refugees the United States will admit to 10,000 over the coming years. Since 2011, when civil war erupted in Syria, the U.S. has admitted fewer than 2,000 displaced Syrians. President Obama also ordered the total number of refugees admitted from all countries be raised from 70,000 to 85,000. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, more than 4 million Syrians have left their country in the past 4 years. And in the last year, about 400,000 individuals have fled to Europe, escaping war, poverty, and crumbling economies in countries across the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia. Most of the migrants and refugees are from Syria. Today, we're going to talk about the settlement process for refugees coming to the United States. We'll also discuss the continuing humanitarian response in Europe and hear the personal story of an asylum seeker who came to America to escape the conflict in Darfur. And right now, we welcome Ruben Chandrasekhar, Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Baltimore. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for the invitation.
Since 1999, the IRC in Baltimore has settled nearly 10,000 refugees and asylees to Maryland, providing assistance from the moment they meet people at the airport. The IRC helps refugees gain housing, employment, and other social services with the goal of moving them toward self-sufficiency and integration. So, Ruben, the IRC in Baltimore assists people resettling in this area. How does the IRC get matched up with them in the first place?
Well, I think to answer that question, we have to understand how the refugee processing takes place. And it's an international process. By definition, refugees are those fleeing persecution, you know, based on their race, religion, political opinion, or affiliation. And during a conflict or when they face persecution and they cross an international border, they could be considered refugees. And it's the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, that makes the determination whether a particular individual or population can qualify under the refugee category. So right now, as you are aware, there are 4 million Syrians who've crossed into neighboring countries of Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, and Iraq. And they have fled a brutal civil war that's raged on for more than 4.5 years that has devastated the country and has displaced an additional almost 8 million people inside their country, in addition to the 4 million who fled. And the UN has determined that all of those people who've crossed the border can be considered refugees because they are fleeing credible fear of persecution and possible death. And when that happens, they get the ability to do two things. One is to stay in those neighboring countries of asylum, like Lebanon or Turkey or Jordan or Iraq, and wait it out and see if the conflict would be resolved, because the first option is always voluntary repatriation, where refugees would actually choose to go back home because no one really wants to leave their home, right? Mm-hmm. They've been forced to do so. But because the conflict doesn't seem to be ending and no end in sight, the second option that the UN and the other countries in the region pursue is local integration. So can the Lebanese government integrate the 1 million refugees that they're currently hosting into their country, give them the ability to work and become citizens ultimately? And that's not always possible. So Lebanon
has a tall order.
It is a tall order. You know, Lebanon has a population of 4 million people, and they're hosting 1 million refugees. So out of a population of 5 million, so 20% mm-hmm. are refugees. That's like the U.S. hosting 60 million refugees. That's an equivalent kind of comparison. So when local integration isn't possible through multilateral agreements signed in 1951 and thereafter, called the Refugee Convention, countries like the United States, Canada, and some European countries have decided to accept refugees in order to help protect them and to alleviate the strain that neighboring countries are facing from hosting refugees for a prolonged period.
So does the UNHCR, the Commissioner for Refugees, mm-hmm. then if a refugee says, no, I don't see any hope. I don't want to stay in this region. I don't see how this region can give me a life. Mm-hmm. First of all, is it up to the refugee to indicate that to the High Commissioner? And secondly, then does the High Commissioner's operation say, okay, you're going to this country, or you will go to this country, or you will go to that country?
Yes. So absolutely, the refugees have the choice of whether they want to try to hold on and hopefully return to that country. Or be given the option to go to this third country for resettlement. And they have the ability to then apply to be resettled in a number of different countries. So Syrians have the option to come to the U.S. because they've been granted refugee status in those neighboring countries. And right now there are about 1,000 Syrian applicants applying to enter the U.S. On a monthly basis. And there's a backlog of about 15,000 applications that the U.S. is trying to process in order to allow these men, women, and children to legally enter the U.S. and begin a new life.
And in the past year, am I right, that mm-hmm. The IRC has resettled 26 Syrian refugees in the Baltimore region?
That's right. That's right. So since 2013, when the Syrian refugees started to be allowed to enter the country, the U.S. has resettled approximately 2,000 refugees, of which the IRC, and we have 26 offices across the country, has resettled approximately 380. And we have resettled 26 individuals in this past year.
So tell me what you do for them.
Yes. Yeah, so the IRC in Baltimore is a refugee resettlement agency, and our primary mission is to work in close coordination with the federal, state, local government, and local partners to welcome refugees who've been allowed to enter into the country. And this past fiscal year, which just ended in September, fiscal year 15, we resettled approximately 830 refugees from different parts of the world.
This is IRC in the U.S.
This is IRC in Baltimore.
IRC in Baltimore.
Yes,
approximately 830
refugees
from around
this,
the world.
This last fiscal year, which ended in September, of which 26 were from Syria. And we provide a range of resettlement services. So the first thing is, as soon as we're notified a family is arriving, we may have like a month's notice. We make sure that we procure housing for them. So a modest apartment, modestly furnished. Then we deploy staff to go to the airport to pick them up when they arrive, take them to the apartment, make sure that they have a warm meal waiting for them because they typically arrive late in the evening. And then each family or individual is assigned to a caseworker who helps assist the refugee transition into life in the U.S. So they provide one-on-one case management services. So things like the first thing would be making sure that they are enrolled for English classes if they need it. Enroll them for some short-term public benefits, so access to health insurance, some limited access to food stamps, and some cash benefits. And then
let me just interrupt there.
Yes.
And ask, how what kind of cash benefits and how long do the food stamps and the cash benefits last?
Yes, it's the U.S. Resettlement system is designed to get refugees self-sufficient very quickly. So typically, a family would be on cash assistance for maybe 4 or 5 months, during which time we orient them to the world that's around them, and most importantly, prepare them to get to work. And I'd say 85% of our clients are working and paying their own bills under 6 months after arrival.
Hmm.
So and it's a tall order. You know, many of them have to obviously acculturate to the U.S. Some of them don't speak English, may have never, obviously have not worked in the U.S. context. But one thing I can say is that if you just picture yourself and, I think of myself, if I were forced to flee my country and I was given the opportunity to start a new life and support my family, how motivated do you think I would be to do that, right? And that's what I see every day. That's what our staff sees every day in our clients. They're extremely resilient. They've gone through a lot. They've lost a lot. But when they get here, they very quickly hit the reset button and say, this is my opportunity to get an education, to get work, and to help support my family, which is what most of them do.
And I have to pick up on that point because I read, and I'm not quickly remembering exactly where I read this. I think it was in a Reuters news piece. You were quoted saying something very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And a skeptic said, yeah, we all hope that refugees, that immigrants in general are going to come in and be totally motivated and totally want to get to work. But is it realistic that Baltimore can go from 26 Syrian refugees to a great many more that quickly? Are you in a position to ramp up what you do? First of all, how many refugees would you be expecting from Syria in the coming year? And are you really in a position, if that number grows a great deal,
it's a great
to
question.
Help them?
Yes. So the processing of Syrian applicants from the point that they apply to when they arrive can be anywhere between 12 to 18 months. So while the Obama administration has said that we'd like to resettle 10,000 Syrians over the next 12 months, it won't be all at once, right? And it won't be all in Baltimore, obviously.
Yes, that's true.
So it's hard to know exactly how many Syrians would come through to Baltimore in over the next 12 months. We anticipate a couple of hundred. To your second question, yes, I mean, Baltimore is a very welcoming community. As you know, the mayor has publicly stated that she wants to welcome 10,000 new families into the city in order to rebuild our population and our tax base. And refugees are one piece of that puzzle. And I'd say just in the last 15 years that we've been operational in Baltimore, we've resettled about 5,000 refugees in Baltimore City alone. And, you know, most of them are working, paying taxes, and now beginning to naturalize and become U.S. citizens and buy homes. So I don't want to paint an overly rosy picture, but I do think if you reference a recent study by the Migration Policy Institute, they published a study, a longitudinal study, was published in June of this year.
Longitudinal meaning they followed refugees.
That's right. They looked
time,
at resettlement data and outcomes over a number of years. And they've discovered very clearly that while refugees do face some challenges, their labor force participation rate, for example, for men is higher than native-born men at 67% versus, I believe, 56%. So, you know, they're extremely motivated to work and lead their life. And I do believe we have the capacity, not only the IRC, but the city, to serve them and welcome them.
Let me also, to your point about it takes a while for people to be admitted. Scott Simon on NPR spoke with Ann Richard, Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration last month. He asked if the U.S. could take in more than the 10,000 that the White House is talking about. And she said the U.S. could make a home for, quote, many, many refugees, close quote. But she also said this.
The tricky part is running a process that scrutinizes the backgrounds of the refugees before they come here to make sure we're bringing people who are legitimate refugees and who do not pose any kind of security threat to the United States. So both of those requirements is what slows down bringing lots of people to the United States.
So security requirements, mm-hmm. What in particular, how are refugees checked out to make sure that they are not a security risk, and how much time does that take?
As I said, for the Syrian applicant, it takes anywhere from 12 to 18 months to get their application processed and cleared before they can enter the country. And all refugees, regardless of where they are from, are subject to multiple and rigorous checks before they're admitted to the U.S. Already very strict, the process has been significantly increased by the Obama administration.
The process has been increased, meaning that the checks go deeper and last longer?
That's right. In fact, the use of biometrics has been deployed. You know, things like iris scans to kind of match up people's identities, multiple interviews, name checks against a variety of databases. And we feel that the system is stronger than it ever has been. And we think it's necessary. I think this is a legitimate concern. That we want to screen people to make sure that those who are arriving are those who have been persecuted. And I think the U.S. refugee resettlement system, including its security apparatus of screening, is one of the most highly sophisticated systems in the world. And we bring in consistently refugees, not people who are persecutors of others, not terrorists.
We're going to take a short break here. You're going to stay with us, Ruben, and I've got more questions. And listeners, I hope you've got questions, too. You can be part of this conversation about refugees settling in Baltimore. We're going to talk in our next segment with someone working in Serbia with refugees there about what they're seeing. You can be part of this conversation if you call us at 410-662-8780. Or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this hour about refugees, the refugee crisis in Europe, specifically about Syrian refugees and what they face as they leave their home in hope of security and a new life. We'd love for you to be part of this conversation. What's on your mind? What worries you about this whole situation? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org or tweet us at the handle MiddayWYPR. Right now, we are joined by Carolyn Brennan. She is Senior Communication Officer for CRS, Catholic Relief Services Emergency Response Team. We're catching her in Chicago, but she also spends time working with refugees in Serbia, and she's recently returned from Serbia. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so glad that you could join us. Tell me what CRS is doing, what Catholic Relief Services is doing in Serbia with the refugees there.
Well, we are working in Serbia and across the Balkan regions in the countries that are really stretched at the capacity in welcoming and absorbing the hundreds of thousands of refugees who are passing through every day in Serbia, Croatia, Macedonia, Albania, and Greece. And the services we're providing range from medical care, literally having doctors on site at these transit camps at these borders to treat people who haven't seen a doctor in months or perhaps years if they've been living inside Syria. And many have been traveling for several weeks. So they're treating their wounds from this very hard, difficult travel, looking at their children, being able to provide care. That's so essential. And then we're also providing translation and information services. And this is so important when you think about the nature of the decisions that people are having to make in this journey. Every step along the way, they're having to decide where to go, who to trust, in what direction they'll end up and will it be safe for them to get there? And they're making these decisions in a foreign language and in a foreign country. And these are decisions that will affect the trajectory of their lives, where they might raise their children and have opportunities. So the pressure of that and deciding what to do and knowing what is correct information with so much misinformation swirling and so much changing. So we have translators who speak fluent Arabic, fluent English, and the fluent, of course, language of that country to help provide clarity of what is possible, what their options are, legal advice where needed, and just to give them a link to some semblance of control as they navigate this very difficult journey.
When were you last in Serbia?
I was on the Serbian border with Hungary, and I returned a little over 2 weeks ago.
And what was your experience there? You just talked about the pressure that refugees are under. Can you give us an example of something that you saw in that setting that you
it
found
was really
troubling?
One of the most, you know, it was one of the most profound trips that I've had with CRS and in my work. And I've met, you know, Iraqis in their country, northern Iraq, who had been recently displaced by ISIS, and Syrian refugees who have sought refuge in Jordan and Lebanon, and have met them, you know, in the places where they live or close to where they're from. And to see them after having made this incredibly long, life-endangering journey, it was really like seeing the rawest form of humanity. You are seeing a flight for survival. And it was so dramatically different from what I was seeing in the news before going out. You're seeing, we often see sort of the aggression on the borders or people fighting on the railroad tracks or near a fence. And what I saw were thousands upon thousands of families simply exhausted, just so physically spent, obviously having the stress, the emotional stress of the decisions that they're having to make, but just so physically tired, but they're moving. No one is stopping for long. They're not stopping in these transit camps, even overnight. They are maybe stopped for a few hours to get some food, some water, some information, a doctor to look at their child or themselves, and then they're moving on. And just that level of exhaustion and desperation was so profound. It is a flight for survival.
It's not gotten very cold yet here in Baltimore, but it is starting to get cold in some places. What kind of problems is weather causing or going to cause for the refugees,
you know,
in transit?
In some cases, it's already causing problems. It was raining pretty much every day that I was there, and it's cold rain. And again, people do not have umbrellas necessarily, so they're making whatever covering they can from plastic bags, you know, to put on their heads, you know, to protect themselves. But it's cold, it's uncomfortable. The doctors are treating a lot of, you know, flu symptoms and blisters, you know, on people's feet and swollen legs from this. And the anticipation is only growing about what this will mean or how this will escalate in winter when it gets really cold, when there's snow and things of that nature to deal with. And, you know, people only have what they can carry. They're not bringing their, you know, multiple coats and blankets of that sort. So there are rising concerns about how this will look even a month or 6 weeks from now.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Caroline Brennan of Catholic Relief Services. And also here in the studio with me is Ruben Chandras. I'm going to screw up your last name, Ruben Chandrasekhar.
That's right.
From Catholic Relief Services.
The International Rescue Committee.
Pardon me?
From the International Rescue Committee.
From the International Rescue Committee. Caroline is from Catholic Relief Services. Ruben, you wanted to add something.
Well, you know, I think it's important to add to what Caroline said and put this these numbers in context, right? By any measure, what's happening today with the Syrian refugee crisis and people coming into Europe is the largest refugee crisis Europe has faced since World War II, right? Let's think about that. And we realize the scale of the refugee crisis during the Second World War. And you have 4 million people from Syria being displaced. Turkey has 2 million refugees currently in that country, and has the distinction of being the country with the largest number of refugees on the planet currently. And when you look at what Caroline said and really look at the trek that these refugees are taking out of Turkey, they're traveling across Turkey, often paying smugglers to help them get across the country, and then take these perilous journeys by dinghies, very fragile floating devices across the sea into places like Lesbos in Greece, and then on to Athens, and then traveling from Athens through Albania, Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, Hungary, Austria, and then Germany. That's an incredible journey. And I think we need to see it on a map to really understand what a long journey this is, and how exhausted these families and how vulnerable these people really are.
Mm-hmm. Caroline, are most of the refugees that you saw when you were on the border there at Hungary, were they trying to get to Germany?
A majority were trying to get to Germany. And just to that point, that was, wonderfully made, is just that desperation. You know, you would have people saying no mother would put their child on one of these rafts if it wasn't safer than their home. These are desperate choices. And people, as they're passing by, they know there's concern about, you know, their intentions. And people will say, we're not the bad guys. We're running from the bad guys. We just want peace. And many of the families that I met were headed to Germany or to Sweden. Some were headed to Norway, other countries. You know, they're hearing information about other countries that are opening their doors to them. And so a lot of people were making their decisions as they were going. But when I was there, primarily Germany was the main destination.
And again, let me make sure I understand, either Caroline or Ruben, either one can help me understand this. When you say that these refugees are headed to Germany, that is their desire, or do they actually have some assurance, some indication that is where they're going to be welcomed, or that there is a space for them there? Caroline?
A lot of the refugees I met had, you know, heard that Germany was opening up its doors to a very high number, 800,000 at the time, asylum seekers, if they met the qualifications for asylum. Most Syrians I met would much rather be back home in Syria the minute it's safe. They did not want to leave in the first place, but had no choice because it was so dangerous. So many were heading to Germany, but also saying, if it becomes safe in Syria again, if I can go home again, you know, that would obviously be the preference. But the sense was that there's a greater number of people who are welcome to apply for asylum in Germany, but there's no guarantee that you will be approved, that you'll meet the qualifications or the standards of asylum. But most were heading there with the thinking it's the greatest chance they have.
Caroline, I really appreciate your talking with us. Thank you for your work, and thank you for your insights.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take another short break here on Midday. When we come back, we're going to meet an asylum seeker from the Sudan who's been in the United States for a couple of years, and we'll hear his story. Stay with us here on Midday on WYPR. Welcome back to Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the response to the refugee crisis in Europe and the refugees the U.S. has pledged to accept. Ruben Chandrasekhar, Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Baltimore, is here with me. There was a point you wanted to make, Ruben.
Well, you know, I just wanted to add a little detail about one of the Syrian families that we've helped to resettle. So this is the story of Mohammed and Amina and their five daughters. Mohammed was a small businessman in Syria. He owned a furniture store and, you know, lived a very normal middle-class life that you and I would probably recognize. And one of the things that they wanted most was a son to kind of complete the family picture. And in spite of the civil war, they continued to live in Syria and make a go of it. He continued to function with his business. And there came a time when his wife got pregnant and they found out that it was a boy, and they were very excited. And then when their son was born, the hospital that he was born in was bombed and his son was killed. And at that point, Muhammad and Amina and their five children said, you know, this is enough is enough. We've tried to hang on and live in our country and lead our life, but we have to be able to protect the other children. And so they made a very difficult decision to travel across the border into Lebanon, where they lived for 2 years between 2012 and 14, partially living on UN aid, partially Muhammad working an odd job to keep his family going. And then when the opportunity opened up for him to apply for his family to come into the U.S., he did. And after about, I think it was 15 months of waiting and processing and security checks and so forth, they were approved and arrived. And we picked them up at the airport in January of this year and have helped to resettle them. His daughters now attend a local high school, public school. The eldest has made the honor roll. And Muhammad is thinking about ways in which he can become an entrepreneur because that's his background. And so he's hoping to get his driver's license and start up a chauffeur service in order to, get that new start in life. So I think it's important to kind of humanize,
And so, again, he has been in Baltimore
since January of
this
year.
Mm-hmm. So he hasn't quite made that six-month average that you talked about people, refugees finding their way into a job.
Yeah, he's actually working.
He is working.
He does work full-time, but he wants to start a business. And, so he's thinking about a chauffeur business. So he's very entrepreneurial, as I think many.
I appreciate your sharing that story. Yep. If you would like to be part of this conversation, if you've got some thoughts about whether the U.S. is doing enough or should be doing more in settling refugees, if you have some concerns that you'd like to express, give us a call, 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. This is a wonderful time for us to meet Abdul Hamid Ali. Abdul Hamid is from the Sudan. He came to the United States in 2013, fleeing violence and genocide in Darfur. I really appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be with you here today.
So tell me about your life in Darfur when the genocide began.
When the genocide started, that was 2002. I was went to Khartoum to join the school, and I left my family in Darfur. And the conflict in Darfur is a political issue.
A political issue.
Yeah, uh-huh. A political issue. That's just the people, they were asking for their basic needs, like good educations, good hospitals, tarmac road, those kind of issue. But the government was denying that, and then the people, they raised their voice, and then they start government start to shut down that voice, and then the war started.
The war started.
The war started.
And you are a journalist, right?
I wasn't being a journalist. I became a journalist because of the conflict in Darfur.
So the conflict turned you into a journalist.
Yes.
As I understand it, you went to Kenya.
Yes.
For safety, to cover the conflict.
Yeah, because I joined a radio called Sudan Radio Service, was focusing on South Sudan, and that radio was funded by the State Department. And so when the war started in Darfur, the deputy manager who was from South Sudan, his name is John Tanza, he was come up with the idea that they're getting some difficult to cover the news from Darfur. So they need some people from Darfur to know well what is going on in Darfur, and then they can just easily collect the information from there and to be broadcasted. So I was the one of the people whom they went was choosing that to collect the news from Darfur and read in Arabic and translate it in the local language. So we were three. And that's when 2008, And we were start that program up to 2013. But the radio was shut down because of the funding.
And I'm trying to understand why you were you not safe to stay in Kenya, or you could not stay in Kenya, or why did you feel you needed to seek refugee status in the United States?
I was in Kenya because to be a journalist, to work with the radio. And then the radio was shut down on 2013, so there's no more need for me to be in Kenya. I got an opportunity to come here in the United States to attend a conference was held in 2013 to focus on what's going on in Darfur. So when I came here to the United States, it will be difficult for me to go back to Kenya or to go back to Sudan. Because definitely if I go back to Sudan, so I will be arrested and might be killed by the government. So because the government thinks that the people whom they, the journalists, and they are staying outside the country, so they might the one whom they're sending the information to international community and to the ICC, International Criminal Court.
So what is your situation now here in the U.S.? I mean, are you legalized here? Are you able to work? What is your status?
My status, I apply for the asylum, and then my application is pending. So I almost have like 2 years now in the United States. But I'm happy I got my authorization card and the Social Security. So it is easy for me to work. But still, I'm getting some difficult because the process is not yet being finished. So I have a child, I haven't seen him. And I have like more than 3 years. I didn't meet my wife. So to meet my wife or my child, so I have to finish my process here. And which is very difficult for me.
How did you end up in Baltimore?
I came to Baltimore in 2013. So yes. And I was staying with one of my friends.
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry. You were...
I was staying with one of my friends.
One of your friends.
Yes. Yeah.
Sheila, if I could add, one of the, I'm very glad to meet Mr. Ali. We actually have a very vibrant Darfuri community here in Baltimore that the IRC has helped to resettle. So there are many refugees from Darfur who've come in through the process that I talked about earlier. And then you have individuals like Mr. Ali who arrived here perhaps to attend a conference or go to school, but couldn't return, and they've applied for asylum. And during that process, the U.S. allows asylum seekers the opportunity to work to support themselves while they wait for the decision of the courts.
Abdul Hamid, I realize you went through many difficult things before you came to the U.S., but just focusing on trying to get settled here, what would you say is the most challenging part of it? What's the most difficult problem that you've had to solve?
The most difficult situation for me and for the others refugees whom they're coming here to the United States is how to start your life here in the United States, because it's the new environment. And so the issue of the culture, which is like the variety of the language, and how to go to work, and the integration into community. So that's the most challenge issue that I faced. And I do believe that so many people whom they are refugees, they're facing the same challenge, especially when the refugees come from the Middle East and their background is they are Muslim. So I think those are the most...
Can you break that down for me a little bit more when you talk about... I mean, essentially, you're talking about trying to understand a different culture. I'm trying to see it through your eyes, because obviously I'm born and bred and deeply inside that culture that you're looking at with new eyes. Yeah. And so it's hard for me to know what's so hard to figure out. What is the big challenge to understand this culture? Americans tend to think we're very open and easy to get to know. That may not be your experience.
It is Okay, the people, they're very wonderful people.
Yeah.
But, okay, I learned the English in Kenya when I was in Kenya for the last five years. But to understand the how the American, they speak, that was a very big challenge for me.
We talk too fast.
The accent.
Yeah, the accent. So the accent.
I didn't hear it.
The accent.
The accent.
The American accent.
Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was a challenge for me. And so I'm thinking, I got an opportunity to learn the English like for 2 years before I came here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that, so, I'm okay. I'm quite okay by English. But I got myself like, I have to go to school from the beginning. So what about the person who don't speak English at all? We have numbers of the Darfurian, they don't speak English. Even they don't speak Arabic. And I'm glad he was us here today, so he know how the issue was there in the IRC. And the other issue is, so throughout the Arabic is starting from the right, but the English is from the left. So when I want to talk, so I have to transfer or to sing in Arabic first, and then I come to to translate it in English. So that was the most difficult. The other issue, it was how to get a work, how to apply for the job. So when I'm asylum seeker, and there is no way for me to go to IRC just to ask for how can they help me. Yes, they do help me for that one. But because I was know that there is some people that they already have the connection with the IRC. But for asylum seekers, it's very difficult for them to start how the life here is going on.
So it's difficult, you say. I mean, and obviously everyone in this economy finds it difficult to find a job. Let me ask Ruben, I'm asking you to generalize about a lot of different refugees you've helped settle, but how does that job search tend to start? I mean, some people bring skills with them that may not be transferable. Some people don't bring skills.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some insight you can give to us about how that process starts?
Yeah, it's a complicated process. I mean, as Mr. Ali was saying, if you don't come here as an asylee, as a refugee, or if you don't have asylum status already, we can't serve you, right? So his status is pending, so we can't formally serve him. But if you do have that status, we have an employment team that works very closely with our clients to help them find work. And, I can't say that we are able to tailor our services to the degree that we would like. So you may have somebody from Iraq, for instance. I know an individual I'm thinking of right now who was a civil engineer. He helped to support the U.S. troops in Iraq, rebuild the country. And then when the U.S. withdrew, he was persecuted and he had to flee. And he came to the U.S. We helped to resettle him. And his first job was not as an engineer. He worked in a parking lot. And that's a difficult conversation that we have to have with high-skilled refugees to say, listen, your skills, while are great, they may not be as easily recognized when you come here. And so it's important for you to start working and pay your bills, and then we'll help you to navigate the process of recertification, right? And that's not easy either, because there are not a whole lot of resources to help highly skilled refugees recertify in their field in this country. So most refugees, when they arrive, end up working in the service sector. In warehouses, in the hospitality industry, so the hotels, the restaurant industry. And then over time, with a combination of classes and learning English, getting certifications in other fields, they begin to move up. And that's how it's done.
That's Ruben Chandrasekhar, Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Baltimore, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Abdulhamid Ali, a asylum seeker who is living in Baltimore while his status is considered. Abdulhamid, did you expect it to take this long when you came? It seems like that's one of the things we're learning, is that the process
I did
take
not
a very
expect
long
to
time.
Take like 2 years, but I was expecting it might be a little bit late because of the situation in Darfur. So I knew that when somebody from Darfur actually apply for the asylum seeker, so the process of the security check, so it has to take some times. So I was expecting that it might be take like 1 year, and because of the whether I'm involved with the rebels or no. So, but now it's getting too long, more than 1 year and a half, and I really don't know what is going on there exactly. But someone of my friend told me that it's getting long because of the those children situation whom they came from Mexico.
The court, the immigration court, is that the correct phrase? The immigration mm-hmm. courts are backed up dealing with the
yes.
the young people who came in over the southern border.
Yeah. But I really don't know what is happening there. Mm-hmm. But right now, I don't have a very big problem for that one, because when the refugees, they can wait for 5 years and they don't know whether they come to the United States or not when they're outside the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that's giving me some encouragement just to be patient here when I'm inside the United States.
How are you keeping in touch with your wife? And you have a son, right?
Yes, I have a son, yeah.
And how are you keeping in touch with them during this week?
My wife, she's living in Khartoum, and the way for the communication is a little bit okay. So I do calling them daily through the phone call. Sometimes we do video call through Skype. Sometimes we're chatting through WhatsApp. That's the way how we get in to know each situation between me and them there.
And she's working in Khartoum?
She's not working.
So how is she keeping body and soul together? Are you sending money, or
yes.
how does it work?
I'm sending money for her and for my family. So I'm working here sending money for them back there. Yes.
Ruben, I think some people may be listening and saying, so what can we do to help here in Baltimore? You talked about how the arrival of refugees and asylum seekers like Abdul Hamid it sort of fits into the city's plan to welcome more families.
Mm-hmm.
But how integrated is it? How much is happening, and what could people do who want more to happen?
Yes, you know, the IRC has been resettling for the last 15 years in Baltimore City and surrounding counties, and we couldn't do it without the support of the community members, not just you know, the federal, state, and local agencies, but actual citizens, you know, you and me, like you and me. So a couple of things. We've had quite a few calls and offers of assistance ever since the Syrian refugee crisis broke out. And, you know, we've been in the news quite a bit of late. So one of the things that we tell people is, if you'd like to donate to the IRC in Baltimore, just look us up. A small financial contribution goes a long way in terms of helping us serve individuals like Mr. Ali and others. And the other one is volunteer your time. We have a very popular family mentor program. We have about 70 mentors, community members, who would like to be of assistance to a newly arrived refugee. And it's a commitment of 6 months, and you spend about 2 to 3 hours a week. It could be teaching them English, could be taking them to an O's game, you know, driving them around the city, you know, just being a guide and a friend and a welcoming presence in their life. And that goes a long way.
So and people can learn more about that at your website.
Absolutely.
Too. We will link to your website from our website. Okay. I really appreciate your being here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the invitation.
Both of you. Ruben Chandrasekhar is Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Baltimore. And Abdul Hamid Ali is a journalist originally from Darfur, lives in Baltimore. He's waiting to hear if his application for asylum will be accepted. Next, stay tuned for Here and Now, and tomorrow at noon, a preview of the Supreme Court's fall session that began this Monday. We'll look at several cases that the High Court agreed to consider, with issues that include affirmative action in higher education, abortion rights, compulsory fees for public sector unions, and the death penalty. That's noon tomorrow. on Midday. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for sharing part of your day with us today. Come back tomorrow.